Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with the supervisor of the Utah Snow Survey, Jordan Clayton. We'll be talking about the latest dismal snowpack forecast and what it means for the upcoming summer water supply. Then, U.S. Ski and Snowboard update with Communication and Marketing Director Andrew Gauthier. Then Park City Education Foundation Executive Director Abby McNulty with an update on what's going on there. Stay tuned. News time now, 8:12. Good morning. Well, the Natural Resources Conservation Service has just released its latest report on Utah's water supply outlook. On the phone to tell us what they found and what it means for this summer's water supply is a supervisor and data collection officer for the Utah Snow Survey, Jordan Clayton. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, sounds good.
Okay. So the report came in on Friday. The reports of snow over the weekend here in the area didn't produce but a couple of snowflakes, so certainly not enough to wipe out the dismal forecast in the report. How bad is it?
Well, it's frighteningly bad. Right now we're looking at well below average snowpack conditions across the state, and particularly in the area that your listeners will be interested in. And complicated by that are the fact that the reservoirs have already been drawn down somewhat relative to where they would normally be this time of year. And we also have really, really remarkably dry soils. And all of those factors are going to combine to limit the amount of water that we get from our snowpack when it does eventually melt. So we really need this winter and this water year to turn around and start getting some bigger storms.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, of course, we're interested in kind of the Weber and Ogden snowpack, as well as the Provo and Jordan. Now, what do those things look like? You said less than half of normal?
Yeah, all those watersheds are hovering around 40 to 50% of normal in terms of the snow water equivalent. That's the amount of water that's in our snowpack. So we really just, we've been getting these nickel and dime storms. So there are, you know, obviously the mountains have a little bit of snow, but it's about half of what it would normally be at this time of year. And that water equivalent in the snowpack is currently not going to be nearly enough to overcome, again, the soil moisture deficit and other factors to produce average runoff conditions. So when all that snow melts, we're expecting at this point well below average runoff. Our forecasts are, in terms of runoff, are in the generally in the 30 to 50 or 60% of normal range.
Wow. So a third of, and that's a third of normal, right? We're not talking about 100%.
That's correct, yeah. And so what we do is we produce a volumetric forecast. So we're looking at the overall amount of water that's going to come from those mountain locations and flow into our rivers from April, the beginning of April until the end of July. And then we treat that as one big volume. We're not in the business of trying to predict, you know, if we're going to have floods or exactly what the peak flow would be. That's the nature of the river forecast centers, and they do a nice job with that. But our business is to try to give you an overall volume of how much we're going to be able to fill up our reservoirs, how much water we expect in our streams and lakes. And those are the forecasts that are looking to be about, again, 30 to 60% of average, depending on where you're looking.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the fact that the soils are so dry going into this. So runoff could actually just be just collected by the soil before we even get it into the rivers, yeah?
Yeah, that's the problem. What we really like to see is an above-average snowpack that melts somewhat quickly, not too quickly to produce floods, but somewhat quickly so that you have saturated soils, meaning that there's really not much more room in the soil for the water to go. And so most of that water then gets routed through the stream network and into our reservoirs. When you have exceptionally dry soils like we have right now, they typically don't change in their level of moisture or dryness through the winter months because they're covered up by the snowpack and there's really not a lot of water coming in or out of them at that time. And then once the snowpack gets to a point where it starts to melt, that water will be introduced into those like little suction cup type soils where it's going to suck up a lot of that available moisture, and a lower percentage of it is going to actually make it into our streams. So it's an efficiency problem.
Yeah. And then you mentioned that the reservoirs have also already been drawn down given the dry summer that we had last year. What do those look like here locally? We've got a number of reservoirs in the Summit and Wasatch County area.
Yeah, it's really variable. If we look at, for example, Echo Reservoir is currently just over 60% of normal. It's a little bit hard because sometimes these trends don't exactly correlate with what's happening in nature because obviously we're in the business of moving water around from one place to another. So, for example, Jordanelle is actually above average for this time of year, but that's just, again, not reflecting the current hydrological conditions. That's just our water management. But one way or another, our reservoir system has been impacted by the fact that we had now two below average snowpack years in a row. Last year's winter was doing pretty well until kind of early spring, and early spring the snowpack really turned off, and quite frankly the precipitation never came back, and we didn't see any of our normal summer monsoon. We had obviously extensive drawdown of our water storage system, our reservoirs, through the summer. And so now we're at a position where the year before our reservoirs were still kind of holding over nicely from the previous year's winter, you know, going back now 2 years where we had done pretty well. Now we drew them down last year, and then we're going to draw them down again. It's to the point now where we really need to start to get concerned about holding back some of that water to make sure we have enough.
So you say Utah's snowpack off to a slow start. Are you optimistic that things could change before winter ends?
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, I'm not a prognosticator, so I don't. And we don't really get into the business of making predictions about what's going to happen with the snowpack. That's the Climate Prediction Center does a nice job with that. That's part of NOAA. That being said, what the near-term forecasts are showing is that we might get a pattern change, a little bit more storm activity towards the end of January. But nothing in the near future. It's looking kind of dismal for the next week or so.
Yeah. So how much longer do we have to collect snowpack? Is that basically through April?
Yeah, that's a good question. We typically get our peak snowpack for the state of Utah right around April 1st. And so those are, you know, it'll vary from around April 7th or depending on which region of the state you're concerned with. But more or less, April 1st is our time of peak snow water equivalent in the state. And after April 1st, we can still get some snow, but we do see typically some melt at some of our lower elevation sites around that time of year as well.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, you measure what's called the snow water equivalent. How does that work? I mean, a foot of snow at an observation site equals how much water?
Yeah, good question. So when the snow first falls, typically in Utah, our water equivalent of that snowpack tends to be around 7 or 8%. So most of that snow depth that you're seeing is just air and ice. And then, you know, obviously that ice has a little bit of water in it. But it's really, that's why we have this beautiful world acclaimed great ski conditions, is that we have really low density, fluffy snow. But the problem is, from a water resource perspective, that light fluffiness means that there's not actually a lot of water content in there. Once the snowpack starts to compact a little bit, our densities in our snowpack, meaning how much water equivalent is in there, will tend to push up. Obviously, we're going to be in the, you know, 20 to up to 35 or 40 even percent range by the time the snowpack is ripe and ready to melt. And also, those lower elevation storms and the storms that we tend to see more in the spring will typically have a higher water equivalent. So to get back to your question, when we get a foot of snow in the winter, kind of this time of year, we would tend to see around an inch or two of water equivalent for each foot of snow that we get. In the spring, that might be more like 3 or even 4 inches of water equivalent, depending on how wet the storm was.
Okay. And then, I mean, I guess it's not you that calls drought, or is it?
The NRCS and the Snow Survey Program do participate in the Drought Assessment Committee, which is part of the DWR for the state of Utah. We work together with multiple agencies and also observers across the state to help assess what the drought conditions are like. So we are part of that conversation. We're, again, an agency that just delivers information, and we don't make management decisions. But we do try to help, again, assess what the current conditions are like. And with that in mind, currently, the state of Utah is really in bad shape in terms of drought. We have about 70% of the state that's in what we would call D4, which is exceptional drought. That's the worst drought category on the list. About 90% of the state is, or actually, I think it's 95. I don't have the numbers in front of me. But it's more than 90% of the state is in D3 or D4, extreme or exceptional drought. So really, there's very, very little portion of the state that's not in severe or exceptional or extreme drought conditions right now, which is, again, a a reflection of the precipitation that we've received or the lack thereof, the soil moisture conditions, the observations that people are making on the ground. All those things combined are reservoir levels to help assess what the drought conditions are like, and it's bad.
So, guys, guess I'm probably asking you to do some high-functioning math here. So don't, if you can't, don't. But, I mean, I guess how many feet of snow would it take then for us to get back to average? I mean, it would have to an onslaught of snow then, right? Because it sounds like
it would be an onslaught, and it's a fair question. We actually produced a number in our report that said around 12 inches more precip just to get back to normal levels of snowpack for our given winter. So if we want to have a roughly, I guess to try to answer that question, if we want to have a roughly average snowpack by the time April 1st rolls around, we'd want to see at least around 12 more inches of water equivalent in our snowpack by the time April 1st is here. And that means, depending again on the density of the snow, I don't know, roughly 9-10 feet of snow across the state. That obviously would vary depending on where you are. The point being, we really need to see these storms start to pile up. Now, even if we get those 12 inches of snow, snow water equivalent in our snowpack across the state, we're not anticipating average runoff. If what we're going to need is above average snowpack just to get average runoff conditions. So we really, again, need to see the storms accelerate.
So in addition to what you call the snowtell reporter and measuring the snow in the higher elevation mountains where the water supply is generated, you also measure what's called SCAN, the current valley conditions. Are those any better?
I'm sorry, but no. I wish I could say that they were. This is a tough time of year to give reports because we'd like to be able to deliver better news, but obviously that's not the situation. The SCAN sites are reflecting very dismal precipitation in those locations as well. And in fact, in some cases, it's worse because some of these storms have been isolated to the mountain locations and haven't hit the valleys at all. The soil moisture in those locations and where we have our SCAN sites is also reflecting very, very dry, well below normal conditions for this time of year. And that's really, again, pretty alarming. We have in Utah one of the densest network of SCAN sites in the nation. And so I think we have about 34 or 35 SCAN sites in the state. And they're not telling a completely uniform picture, but more or less the story is exactly what we've been talking about, well below average precipitation and extremely dry soils.
Okay. Anything else you think is worth noting here and as part of your recent report?
Well, I think it's not our business to, again, manage the water system in Utah, but I would say for listeners, there's no harm in starting to think about how we can use less at this time. Obviously, we're going to hope for more supply, and we're going to hope for more snowpack, but we also want to work on the demand part of that equation and start thinking about the very likely possibility that we're going to have to manage a very limited amount of water for this coming spring and summer.
Okay. Jordan Clayton is the supervisor of the Utah Snow Survey. Thanks so much for your time this morning. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
On the phone now with an update from the U.S. Ski and Snowboard team, I have Marketing and Communications Director Andrew Gauthier. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So let's see. Let's start with men. Alpine, some good news and bad news there with Tommy Ford.
Yeah, you said it. I'll start with some of the results here, but we had a double GS program as well as one slalom in Adelboden, Switzerland. Tommy Ford led the way, finishing 10th. Ryan Carpensiegel was right on Tommy's tails in 12th, and River Radamus collected his best GS finish in 18th. So good to see River come out as a young athlete pulling in some results. The general vibe in Adelboden was a bit strange, quiet with a usually pretty crazy crowd around 30,000, 40,000 people, which is crazy to think about. And this year, empty. And so the athletes definitely were dealing with a different environment. But this was Tommy's fourth top 10 GS finish in a row with his second place podium in Santa Catarina. And he's yet to be bested in 2021 this season. Adelboden was Ryan's best giant slalom result since he was 11th in Solden last season. But the most exciting story of the day was definitely River Radamus, on January 8th with his best GS finish. On the 9th, things changed a little bit. It was a rough day with for the Americans, headlined by a massive crash, as you mentioned, by by Tommy Ford. There is some positive news for Tommy's fans out there. Prior to loading to the helicopter, Tommy was conscious and speaking to emergency responders. He was taken to the hospital for evaluation. Tommy's head and neck injuries are minor and resolving nicely. He has a knee injury that they're doing a bit of further evaluation. So those who follow Tommy on social media, definitely send him your love and support. It'll definitely go a long way. Outside of Tommy on the ninth, Ryan Carpentier led the way for the men, finishing 19th and River Adamus in 20th. There was one more event with a slalom on Sunday, which is Luke Winters, where he scored his first World Cup ski points, finishing 22nd for his fourth career point score. The men will stay in Switzerland for the classic Lauberhorn downhill on Friday. And unfortunately, just got news that the events in Wengen, Switzerland, were canceled after analysis of the current COVID situation in Switzerland. So event organizers continuing to be very cautious and protecting the athletes to the best of their ability. We also had events for the women, starting with a downhill in St. Anton, Austria. Beautiful day, perfect surface, and Breezy Johnson put the hammer down, grabbing her third-place podium in as many downhill races in St. Anton. A little fun fact for you from our researcher, Megan Harrod. Coming into Saturday, the women in the U.S. had won the last two World Cup downhill events in the ski resort, Lindsey Vonn in 2007 and Alex McKenna-Duran in 2013. A lot of credit going out to official training site Copper Mountain, Colorado, for the amazing preparation period they had in November, which is really helping the speed team be successful this season. And the Landover U.S. Alpine Ski Team continues to show depth, with the first-year U.S. Ski Team member Isabella Wright scoring her first career World Cup points, moving from bib 45 to 27th. Moving into Sunday, there was a Super G. Another beautiful day, great conditions, can't ask for more. And Isabella Wright led the way for the team, grabbing a personal best 24th place and scoring her first Super G points, just one day after scoring her first career World Cup points. The Czech women head to Flachau, Austria for the classic night slalom on Tuesday. And so, unfortunately, a crash with Tommy, some solid results from the young athletes on the Alpine side, and then we also had Breezy holding down the downhill in a big way.
Okay, let's move on to cross country with the wrapping up of the Tour de Ski.
Yeah, amazing. Honestly, just an amazing performance by the whole cross country team. Jesse Diggins finished second in the final stage of the 15th Tour de Ski to become the first American to win the Tour de Ski overall title. I mean, what an accomplishment on that side. But, you know, Jesse wasn't the only one skiing well throughout the week. Park City's Rosie Brennan overcame two crashes in stage 6 and 8 to rally back and finish 6th overall, a career-best result for her. As far as the overall standings, Jesse now leads the overall World Cup standings in cross-country. Rosie's in third. However, Rosie still leads the overall World Cup distance standings. And again, more young guns stepping up. Gus Schumacher finished 19th in the final stage to finish 18th overall, the best Tour de Ski finish ever for an American man. He also moved to 27th in the overall World Cup standings. So looking at the big picture here, we have four American women finished in the top 24 overall, in addition to Jesse's win and Rosie in sixth. Haley Swerbel competing in the Tour de Ski for her first time, finished 15th in the final stage and 18th overall, as well as Catherine Arjun, who was 24th Sunday to finish a career-best 23rd overall. So, I mean, history was made at the Tour de Ski on both the men's and women's side with Jesse's win and Gus having the best male finish in the history. And they will head to, the cross-country team will head January 23-24 to Lahti, Finland to continue World Cup competition.
All right, let's move on to freestyle. What's going on there?
So Moguls is on a bit of a break, working hard, training locally at the Utah Olympic Park, as well as in Colorado. The next World Cup event for this crew is Deer Valley, right in the backyard there. And then Ariel's had a great week, also locally in Park City. The U.S. national team competed in three events over the last week, two NORAMs, January 5 and 6, and the U.S. national championships, January 9. Just want to take a moment and give a huge thank you to the Utah Olympic Park and Park City Ski and Snowboard for hosting and just doing an amazing job keeping all the athletes safe. Although the January 5th NORAM was cut short due to wind, obviously those tall kickers definitely provide an issue when the wind's blowing. The rest of the week provided beautiful days and perfect conditions for jumping. Ashley Caldwell claimed her fifth U.S. championship title, and Chris Lewis claimed his second. The team, right after the competition, had just enough time to shower, get their clothes together, pack their bags, and board flights Sunday morning to Russia for 3 weeks of back-to-back competition. This coming weekend features two events. The first, with the Mixed Team Aerials World Cup of the season. That's the first event of the season in that discipline, as well as Mixed Team Aerials will also make its debut in Beijing in 2022. So exciting to see that event surface for aerials this weekend.
Okay. And they're going to be back. They'll be back at Deer Valley, at the end of the month?
Yeah, exactly. It's early February, February 4 through 6. But the event will definitely look a bit different this year. Competition is going to take place during the day, and there'll be no spectator access. We want to encourage all the community. We know they love this event, but in the interest of safety, we want to encourage the community to watch from home. All the watch information will be available at uskiandsnowboard.org. Venue access will be extremely limited to essential personnel. And, you know, we just appreciate everyone's cooperation. We want to make sure that our athletes have a chance to compete domestically. And, you know, the health and safety of event staff, resort staff, and guests and athletes is on the top of mind.
Okay. And then the free ski and snowboard teams.
Yeah. So it felt like a long time, just about 2 months since the first Park and Pipe World Cup. But we had the top performing athlete was on the free ski side with Alex Hall, right out of Salt Lake City, finishing eighth in Friday's heated fifth Big Air World Cup season opener in Kreisberg, Austria. Kreisberg was the home of the 2015 World Championship, so familiar sight for all our athletes. Hall had a strong showing, landing both his first and third run. And on the second run, he actually lost a ski about midway through a 70-foot jump. It was quite a spectacle. He was okay. Went on to land his third run, but was unable to break into the top three with just an amazing level of skiing. You could tell that all the athletes had a bit of extra time to train this year as they came in absolutely dialed. Definitely no rust to be found there. On the snowboard side, Chris Corning was the top American, finishing 16th in a stacked field of about 65 athletes. And Hawaiian and teammate Lyon Farrell also broke the top 20, just rounding it off there in 20th place. Next up, the U.S. snowboard team is going to head to Lax, Switzerland for the Lax Open, January 13th through the 18th. Lax is viewed as the premier snowboard event in Europe and a favorite among many of the riders. We have Julia Marino defending her slopestyle title, and as well as Taylor Gold, Red Gerard, and Judd Henkes all looking for their second consecutive podiums after strong performances last year. The U.S. freeski team will have to wait a little longer until X Games Aspen 2021 at Buttermilk Mountain, January 29th through 31. And Snowboard Cross is set to kick off their season this month, January 22, in Chiese in Val Flamenco, Italy. And so everyone's starting to finally get going. The season's in full swing. We're seeing success across the board in what was a really difficult off-season, as we all know. And we're really happy to see our athletes performing.
Yeah. So in terms of like half-pipe competition, is that even happening anywhere? I mean, certently we don't have a half-pipe. Yeah.
Yeah, so there are limited half pipes across the U.S. and even internationally, but the Lax program in Switzerland will have a half pipe in addition to slopestyle. X Games Aspen 21 will also have half pipe competition, and we hope that we'll also reschedule the Mammoth Land Rover U.S. Grand Prix, which will have a half pipe program as well. And so there are events on the schedule, but you're right, with the cancellation of the Copper Mountain World Cup, which kicks off the season, it's been tough for the half pipe riders. But by the same token, and selfishly, they've had some amazing training opportunities thanks to our partners at Copper Mountain. And so everyone's in prime form when we can get competition ready to go.
Okay. Hey, Andrew, anything else you want to mention?
You know, I just want to say thank you to all the supporters of U.S. Ski and Snowboard throughout the pandemic. We have an exciting announcement coming down the wire this morning. So I encourage you guys, all our fans, to check uskiandsnowboard.org later this morning for some really exciting news about what we've been able to accomplish this offseason.
Okay. Andrew, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie. Have a great day.
That's Andrew Gauthier, the Marketing and Communications Director with U.S. Ski and Snowboard. A Utah man, as we've been reporting, has died after being buried in an avalanche Friday morning. It occurred in the backcountry terrain on the Canyons Village side of Park City Mountain Resort. Tragically, his girlfriend witnessed the slide. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
The Summit County Sheriff's Office received the call notifying them of a slide and a possible burial in the avalanche-prone area known as Dutch Draw. Summit County Sheriff's Lieutenant Andrew Wright earlier in the day confirmed the 31-year-old was buried, and there were about three dozen rescue workers who responded to the scene.
Had gone up the 9990 lift and went into the back country. She just tells our investigators who are here on scene that he wanted to go, of course, back into the back country and went off into the Dutch Draw area. She describes that he triggered an avalanche and watched him get buried.
Rescue personnel assisted, but they had to do additional control work before it was safe to send anyone else into search for the victim.
And we are now deploying rescuers via our search and rescue snowcat and snowmobile. They are taking medical personnel, deputies, and other ski patrol personnel in there to attempt to locate this male. The DPS helicopter does have technology, the RICO technology, that basically they have the ability to get a reflection signal off of ski jackets. It's a new technology that's in a lot of ski jackets, and they were able to confirm that they did get a response from that. So we do believe, based off of the first-hand witness of the wife and the technology that we've utilized, that we do have the male buried under the slide.
Wright said he did not think either the man or woman had rescue equipment with them, such as shovels, probes, beacons, an Avalon or float pack. It's common for people who want to ride in the backcountry in the Park City area to leave the resort through a gate at the top of the 9990 chairlift. The area is boldly signed with skull and crossbones, warning those who leave the resort that they are doing so at their own risk.
And so it would be up to them to determine whether or not those gates are closed. But yes, it is outside of the resort. The resort has no responsibility of this terrain. You do leave safer area and go into the backcountry with a very straightforward, very blunt sign that lets you know that there's a very high risk to your life safety, and that we don't suggest people go. It seems like we deal with this, unfortunately, lately. It seems to be on a yearly basis.
Rescuers, with the help of a Park City Mountain Ski Patrol avalanche dog, located the male at the toe of the avalanche, approximately 2 feet below the surface. The avalanche was estimated to be 50 feet wide with a 200-foot vertical drop. This week, the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center has reported a high probability of natural and human-caused slides due to the current snow conditions. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
And again, the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center has more details on this avalanche. Unfortunately, the man that was buried and killed was a snowboarder. He was midway down the slope when the skier started her descent after making a couple of turns, the avalanche then breaking at her feet. The snowboarder, of course, just midway down the slope where he was then caught, carried, and buried. It cannot be determined how the avalanche was triggered, likely triggered by at least one of the two people or possibly both. Well, Summit County's planning staff has received a flurry of new requests in recent weeks, in particular coming with the new year. Summit County Development Director Pat Putz says they've received an application from Dakota Pacific for a use under the current approval for a tech park at Kimball Junction. That comes even while Dakota Pacific's proposal to revise the entire property to a residential commercial neighborhood is going to a public hearing before the Summit County Council this week. KPCW's Rick Bruff has details.
The Boyer Tech Park was approved about 12 years ago. Putz said that some 6 or 7 years ago, they drew up a list of uses for the project that are either allowed or granted as a conditional use. They also devised a process to determine if a use is allowed in the project.
In the event that there was proposed use that would go into the park that maybe needs a bit more study if it complies with that use table, that process is available. We did receive an application for use determination from Dakota Pacific. It is for medical facilities. I've assigned that to Peter Barnes to help shepherd through the process. The way that use determination works is an application submitted, a description is provided, and then the county manager, the planning director, community development director, and the chair of the planning commission sit down and do an evaluation and make a determination. The determination, you know, one way or another, is appealable to the council.
He said they asked Dakota for more information on the request and are still waiting to hear back.
It would be allowed. I think the question is, with the proposed changes, is this something that can be done? And the answer to that is yes, because it's already built into the existing entitlement process. If it was determined to be consistent with that use chart, it would just be part of that remaining, you know, 1.2 million square feet left to build out on the property. They would just move forward and build it. If it is determined to be an allowed or a conditional use, they would be able to do it by right. The process would be similar to what we went through when we built the Skull Candy building or the Chamber Bureau building. It'll go through a final site plan with the Planning Commission.
Putt said his office has received over two dozen other applications. For example, one is requesting a low-impact permit for the Echo Divide Wind Tower project near Echo Canyon. The applicant is looking for some test towers to evaluate the wind in the canyon area. In addition, Putt said that Habitat for Humanity submitted a subdivision plat for a residence they will be building in Silver Creek Village. And at the other end of the basin, the Wileman School near Kilby Road is asking for an addition to its building. For KPCW, I'm Rick Baroth.
Well, the COVID-19 numbers are still high throughout the state following the holiday last week. The Utah Department of Health announcing close to 2,300 new COVID-19 cases yesterday. That's more than 450 more cases than the state saw a week ago. Summit County's case numbers have been spiking in the past week. Summit County saw two of its high single-day case counts on Sunday. The health department reported 55 new cases. In comparison, last Sunday reported 11 new cases. Wasatch County reported 38 new cases. Last Sunday, the county saw 11. Utah Department of Health reporting two new deaths. Almost 1,400 Utahns have died due to COVID-19, including six from Summit County and 16 in Wasatch County. The state also saw an increase of more than 10,000 new tests administered. The state's seven-day rolling average for positive tests is over 31%. Summit County's seven-day average of positive lab tests is nearing 26%, and more than 32% of the tests coming back are positive on average in Wasatch County. Utah Department of Health reported 88 new hospitalizations. There are 541 people in the hospital for COVID-19 in the state. Statewide, more than 90% of referral center ICU beds are in use. Close to 3,200 people have been vaccinated for COVID-19 since Saturday, bringing the number to 102,809 first doses administered. Well, after taking a break in 2020, the park's Silly Sunday Market planning to return in July. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has more.
During a normal year, the Park Silly Sunday Market takes place every Sunday of the summer on Park City's Main Street. The event hosts hundreds of vendors and brings out thousands of guests every weekend. Last year, they had to cancel the summer markets as well as winter holiday events due to the pandemic. Kate McChesney is the executive director of the event. She says it was a tough decision to cancel because she knew vendors would see a loss in revenue, but she says ultimately public safety was a larger concern.
We bring 15,000 people to the street every Sunday. On holiday weekends, even more. And there was no way we were going to put this community in jeopardy.
This year, the market is planning to return in July as long as the health department gives the go-ahead. McChesney says they're willing to be flexible to accommodate health restrictions.
Also understand that there's probably going to be some mitigation. There's probably going to be some vendors removed, you know, so we can open up the street because we have a lot of bottlenecking when we have a traditional Sunday. So, you know, we're open to do all of that, but having the actual exactly what it's going to look like will probably change all the way through May.
Vendor applications for the market are already listed online. McChesney says within the first 24 hours of posting the application, they already had 35 vendors in the queue. Applications can be found at the event's website, parksillysundaymarket.com. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
On the phone now with an update from the Park City Education Foundation, Executive Director Abby McNulty. Good morning, Abby.
Good morning.
First, at the first report of the year, you wanted to just mention what the foundation is and what it does.
Yeah, so as many might know, the Park City Education Foundation funds initiatives that inspire all students to reach their academic and lifelong potential. This year, we have really focused additional funding on focusing support on the whole child, making sure that our students are engaged and supported. And we're really grateful because of support also from Park City Community Foundation that we've been able to extend that support not just to our students, which has always been our focus, but also to our Park City School District family this year, including families of students as well as our education staff too. And that's been a really wonderful opportunity in the middle of this pandemic to be able to pivot to support everyone in our school community.
All right, coming up tomorrow night is a family mental health night. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so in collaboration with Park City School District, the Park City Education Foundation, Communities That Care, and the Cook Center for Human Connection, we are offering a parent mental health support event, giving parents tools to answer some of the challenges that students may be facing this year, mental health and wellness issues that have been brought forth because of the pandemic. It's a chance to hear from leading family therapists who have provided the district with a free resource. So it's tomorrow night. It's a virtual event. It's that's January 12th, and it's from 5 to 6 p.m., and you need to register in advance. You can go onto the Park City School District's website or onto pcef4kids.org under the event tab.
Okay, so what do you think people are going to get out of it?
Well, I think people will get out of, I'm a parent myself. I've got a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old. And as recently as last night, my 12-year-old was just feeling incredibly anxious about going to school. You know, we've had some close encounters over the last week with COVID, and his anxiety is running quite high. As a parent, you know, my job is to support him and, you know, help him work through his anxiety, and I don't always know how to do that, to be honest with you, because I have my own anxieties. It's been a really hard start to the year. So the goal of this event is to give parents resources and tools to help their kids be emotionally supported through these really challenging times.
Okay, let's see. The Education Foundation has been funding programs that support kids' social and emotional health through the Classroom Grants Program. What are some of those programs that have been run over the last few years to help with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And our Classroom Grants distribute anywhere between $400,000 and $500,000 into our schools every year, reaching all 5,000 students in every school. A Whole Child has been a piece of that work for many years. One of the more significant programs that we've invested in over the last 3 years that's really been very fruitful and very useful this year is a mindfulness program across the school district, which included a 3-year pilot at Ecker Hill, training teachers on how to incorporate mindfulness into their classrooms. Teacher burnout has been a real issue for many, many years. We're obviously seeing that more now and as part of the national conversation because of the pandemic and the extra pressures and responsibilities on teachers. And mindfulness is a way to support teachers in their daily practice of education. And then it's also a way to provide students with tools as well, like my son, for example, who is, you know, can be anxious. It's a great opportunity for him to have a teacher lead a mindfulness practice in class. It's only 1 or 2 minutes long, but it helps ground the students and help them, you know, through a deep breath or through a gratitude activity to feel more grounded. We've also funded restorative justice programs at Treasure Mountain. Let me add real quick too, we have funded mindfulness programs in nearly every single school in the district from elementary to high school. And so that's really been important this year. We've also funded restorative justice programs at Treasure Mountain, and restorative justice focuses on mediation and community building rather than isolation and punishment for students, making sure that everyone's part of the community, supported. And then, you know, this year too, as I mentioned earlier, Park City Community Foundation and CARES funding has allowed us to provide financial resources to families in financial crisis, which has been a huge lifeline for many families who lost income because of the pandemic and the economic closures back in March. And the repercussions still ripple through our community today.
Okay. The Ed Foundation has also helped take care of things as basic as hunger. How have you helped there?
Yeah, and that's the financial relief we've been providing to Park City School District families. And so back in March, when schools closed and the economy essentially stopped, a lot of our families lost all sources of income and really went into crisis. We were able to provide gifts of cash to families in our school district to be able to buy things like, you know, formula for their babies and diapers, things that weren't found in the food pantry at the time, or cleaning supplies, masks, things like that. Because as you know, if you're in crisis, it's really hard to help support your kids focus in school. So sometimes taking care of basic needs becomes the priority. And that was certainly the case last spring. And we're continuing to see the ripple effects of that economic closure and impact still today. So we're continuing to distribute cash resources to families in Park City School District, and that includes not just families of students, but also our education staff who might be experiencing severe economic hardship for one reason or another.
Okay. Finally, the Ed Foundation has added a educator wellness initiative for this year. What's that for this year?
Yeah, so as we know, we have become very acutely aware, and we talk about all the time, it's crystal clear now more than ever, our schools and teachers are essential for success of families and for the success of our community and economy, and our education staff is really the backbone of that. Evidence proves that educators are the number one impact on student achievement, and so this year, thanks to donors, we've been able to create an educator wellness initiative to address some needs that our education staff might have specifically. And honestly, it could be something as simple as giving them a warm cup of coffee. So Lucky Ones Coffee Camper has made its way to every school. It did in December, and actually they are back at it this January to say thank you and to provide our education staff with a cup of coffee, a free meal to start their day. And we're so grateful to partner with Lucky Ones to do that. And also this latest round has been funded by Communities That Care and the Cook Center for Human Connection. So something as small as that, just a collective thank you to our teaching staff, goes a long way. And I will say our educators are grateful. We've also created a page on our website for educator wellness offers for special prices on meditation classes, mindfulness classes, yoga classes. The community has stepped up to provide our teaching community with some additional benefits to help get through this very challenging year.
Okay.
And anyone can find those resources at pcf4kids.org.
So have you guys taken any part in getting the teachers vaccinated?
We're following it along closely. Obviously, we think that that's incredibly important. We're here, you know, if the school district needs assistance financially or planning-wise, if they need it. But I think that there's still a lot of unknown information as far as timeline and how it will roll out. So, but that's definitely a great question for Park City School District.
Okay. Abby, anything else you want to mention?
Just thank you so much to the community for continuing to support our education community. And if people haven't, I encourage them to take a moment just to say thank you to the teachers of their kids with a quick email and share their appreciation.
All right. Abby McNulty, Executive Director of the Park City Education Foundation. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Utah remains among the most rapidly growing states, even as its pace of change slows down over time. The Deseret News reporting the Beehive ranks fourth for population growth in the one-year period that ended in July. That's according to estimates from the U.S. Census Bureau. The state added nearly 47,000 people in that time frame, slightly smaller than the population of Draper, and a statewide increase of 1.5%. In a longer time frame, Utah's 17.6% growth rate over the last decade outpaced everywhere else in the nation but Washington, D.C., which recorded an 18.5% increase, up to nearly 713,000, the national rate much lower at just 6.7%.